Warming temps and heavy rains can spell trouble for your home. Don't wait for a problem. Get a free foundation inspection from PermaSeal. Stay dry, stay protected. For peace of mind, call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Eric Zorn joins us on Tuesdays at this time. He's the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, the weekly newsletter. You remember him long as the longstanding Chicago Tribune columnist. Now he's got his own unending column, if you will, that he drops on. When do you drop each episode publication, each newsletter, Eric?
Well, I drop it on Thursdays, but on Tuesday mornings, there's something I call Picayune Plus, which is for paid subscribers. I send it out to them, just a little extra. I do a lot of correspondence with readers there, and I do my little visual tweets poll every week on the Picayune Plus. So it comes out twice a week.
Eric, we've spent some time today talking about the migrant tents. I guess construction of the one in Brighton Park goes up today, or begins to go up today. And I said that while it's not perfect, it's a reasonable solution. And I don't think these people are going to be more likely to commit crimes. It's not a residential area per se where they are. People live near there, but it's not a neighborhood. It's an old zinc smelting field, and it's not the place you would probably want to live, but these people can survive more comfortably there. So while it's not in my backyard, I don't have a problem with this, and I asked my audience to explain to me why they're so hostile to it. I've got a number of reactions, but in general, what do you think about what I think about this solution?
Well, I think it's a bad solution, but it may be the best of the bad solutions right now. They're not going to be able to find permanent indoor housing for all the people that need it urgently during this season. So this may be a stopgap. I think people are worried that it's going to last much longer than maybe a winter and next summer, and it's going to become sort of a permanent encampment. And it is true that there is a correlation between poverty and crime. And if you put a bunch of people living in a tent camp who can't work, who can't even get work permits in many cases, there's going to be a lot of poverty there, and with that may come some crime. I mean, I'm not sure I would disagree with those fears that people have. There's also a question of whether that site it has some toxic chemicals still, because it was a smelting plant before.
Yep.
So it was a vacant field.
Yep, it was.
So there's that. I mean, I just don't know what else you could do, right? I mean, where else are these people going to go? People talk about, well, gee, we could put them in McCormick Place, or we could put them into some of these vacant office buildings. But that's really not a solution. It's really there's a lot of problems with that. And the papers have covered why they can't just say open up a couple of vacant floors at the Prudential Center or wherever there might be vacant floors and let them live there. That there are all kinds of problems with that. So as long as this is seen as a temporary solution to the problem, as long as that we're getting on the case of creating enough permanent housing for people, because I don't think a lot of these migrants are going to be going anywhere. I think a lot of them probably have valid asylum claims and will become permanent residents of Chicago. And I've said all along that I don't consider this a migrant crisis. I consider it a migrant challenge. And in the long run, I think it is a migrant opportunity. Our city, our state has been losing population, and to have new people coming in, new younger people coming in who are willing to work, who are able to work, and obviously very determined people who have traveled great distances to be here. I think they're going to end up being a real asset to the city in the long term. In the short term, it's a real challenge to deal with them. But in the long term, I think we're going to be really glad that these people have made the trip here and are living here.
Didn't the mayor say that after 60 days, they will have to go elsewhere? And where will they go? Do you have a feel or an understanding of that?
I don't know what exactly that means. I don't know because he's talking about the people who are in shelters, who they are going to provide shelter living to. And they give them a 60-day time limit.
Yeah.
And then do you just throw them out on the street? And times they've asked that question, seems to me, to the mayor's office, there's a lot of hamana. They don't know where they're going to go. And I think I get what they're doing, which is they want to create a sense of urgency. They don't want people to get too comfortable or too settled in a shelter situation. Shelters tend to be not for people who are chronically there, but for people who need emergency help for to tide them over between in a tough time. And then you move on to something more permanent. Shelter housing is not a long-term solution. It's a short-term solution. And I think that they want to underscore that by setting this time limit. I don't have any idea what they're going to do when people start bumping into that time limit, when there aren't places for them to go. I think they said that if they have shown some progress in trying to find a place to live, that they will allow them to stay. It reminds me a little bit of how unemployment insurance works. Mm-hmm. Like you get unemployment payments if you can show that you've been looking for work, and maybe people will have to show that they've applied for apartments. But I don't know how they're going to afford apartments if they can't work. So I'm not sure what they're doing, except maybe trying to underscore to people that it is important for them to keep looking for places to go.
Well, the key to everything is us streamlining a way for them to make money. If they can make money, they'll be less likely to commit a crime. They can feed themselves. They can save some money and get an apartment. They can team up with another family and get an apartment. I mean, if they can't make money, there's no solution. If they can make money, there is. We have to do that.
Well, I totally agree, and I think we need to streamline on a federal level, on a state level, and a local level in any way we can to allow these people to work legally, to give them taxpayer IDs, give them documentation so that they can work, because keeping them on the dole, I don't think they want to be on the dole, a lot of them. I mean, you got to remember, these people have made an arduous journey here. They're not, this is not a casual thing that's made them show up in Chicago thinking there might be a better life here. They have escaped what they believe to be is an intolerable situation, and many of them in Venezuela, and they've taken an incredibly long and difficult journey. These are people who are, I think people who are of strong character and people who are willing mm-hmm. to go out of their way and work hard. And we need employees everywhere you go. You see help wanted signs in the city. So I think it could be. I mean, I really do think in the long run it's going to be a win-win. In the short term, we've got this problem that, where are they going to stay? And then you've also got the problem of all the resources that are being directed to these new arrivals. And a lot of people in the disadvantaged communities, especially the minority communities, are saying, hey, where's ours? You've got all this money suddenly for people coming, people coming from Venezuela, but you didn't have money all these years to invest in our neighborhoods and invest in housing where we live. And so I understand that, and you're sensing a lot of that. There's a lot of friction in the city.
Okay, but I just want
that.
Every time we say that, nobody says, "Well, here's how much money, here's how much opportunity, here's how much service, in fact, is given to the poor or the homeless, the impoverished communities in Chicago." We have them, but I don't know that we have 100% neglected them. I wonder if we just compare resources and money and services, how it would stack up. I understand the what about mine, but I haven't heard the mine part of that either. It's not like it's zero, right? Somebody explain to me how, in fact, disenfranchised these people are compared to people who have come here with nothing on their back, with everything on their back, and legal asylum status.
Right. No, I think you make a good point. And I'm not in a position to say, because I don't live in one of those neighborhoods, what kind of disinvestment there has been in them, what kind of support has been given to these communities for business, for housing and so on. I just know that I've heard a lot of these complaints, and it might be just opportunism talking there. But I have mm-hmm. a sense that these neighborhoods do feel very neglected over the years, and that when they're seeing the wallets opening up for the new arrivals, they're thinking, well, why weren't the wallets opened up for us? And again, I can't referee that claim. I can only say that it's clearly causing a lot of friction. And you see that when you see the news coverage of some of these community meetings where people are coming out and saying, hey, what's going on here? This is city money. This is state money that could have been going to.
Okay, but they're not handing these people wads of 20s. They're providing them shelter. And I guess we are providing for them for some food and medical care, but they're not giving them cash. What are these people getting that other people in the city aren't getting? Would you trade your lot with them? I mean, it doesn't look to me like it's luxurious, the life that we're affording these people, both the ones sleeping on the floor at the police station or living wherever right now in some sort of shelter. I don't know that that's any lap of luxury.
No, I think you're right. And again, I'm not the person to talk about this, but I think you can probably find people from those communities to talk about what specifically their complaints are about it. But there is a sense that, there was $150 million from the city and another $300 million from the state. That money was there, and they could find it for them, but they couldn't find it for us to invest in our schools, in our parks, in our youth centers, in our health centers, in our mental health places like that. I mean, there are all kinds of areas where people are saying that the city has not properly invested in these neighborhoods. And it's not like that. Oh yeah, we want our tents. We want our free meals or whatever, that they want sort of a deeper sort of investment in the communities. And I mean, I think it's just sort of a natural outgrowth of people who are feeling dispossessed and marginalized. So.
Right. Hold on. It's 11:46. That's Eric Zorin. His Picayune Sentinel comes your way Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I've got a couple of other things I wanted to bounce off of you, Eric, based on stuff you've been writing about. Was it a letter to you, Eric, or an email? Somebody asked about sports, and you were talking about pitch clocks and whatnot. I was talking about that on my radio show this week. What are you doing there?
Well, it has to do with the pitch clock revision in baseball was a huge success. I think everybody agrees that the season went much better because the games were shorter and the action moved along. And then the question becomes, well, what about some reforms in football to make the game go a little bit faster? And I started looking into, for instance, the 2-minute warning is an artifact from way back when the referees just kept the time and a stopwatch in their pocket, and players didn't know how much time was left in the game. So you called a 2-minute warning so that you'd let them know that the game was about to end. Now, of course, that they don't need that at all anymore. The only reason they have a 2-minute warning, seems to me, in the NFL is to sell more commercials. And it all came up because someone was saying, why do they call the penalty a delay of game? When they don't snap the ball within, 35 seconds? But I think it's different in the pros and in college. But you don't snap the ball a certain amount of time. It's delay of game. Are they really interested in moving the game along? And my answer is, well, they take 4-minute commercial breaks after every punt. So how can they call this a delay of game? Well, what it is, it's a play clock violation. And I have some suggestions as how to improve football. And one of them would be that you could get rid of those weird plays at the end of the game where they go in victory formation and kneel down to run out the clock, or the team that's behind has to run up and spike the ball. That they should just, in the last 2 minutes or the last minute of every half, that every play, the clock stops at the end of every play, whether it's a run, an incomplete pass, a complete pass, the clock stops. And then it starts again on the snap. And that way, you have to play the game all the way to the end. Baseball games, you got to play all the way to the end. You can't kill the clock in baseball. There's no clock in baseball. You have to get the last out in the last inning to win the game. And in football, you have this weird end-of-game ritual where players are spiking the ball, and they don't call it intentional grounding, even though it's intentional, and he's throwing it on the ground because they want people to be able to stop the clock. And I don't understand why the game hasn't reformed those last minutes, because the last minutes in football games are tedious and weird often. And I think that a team should have to keep playing the game right until the very end.
Or they're very exciting, and that's why they're spiking the ball or running up and before the clock runs out. But that's because the game is close. And you're making me think, Eric, that it would be interesting to see, rather than can they get the play off, can they successfully complete a pass or score? You know, let's not make the object of the game accomplish a play. Let's make it successfully accomplish a play. Let's see if you can do it rather than just literally get the ball hiked in time. I think you're onto something there. To be honest with you, I don't know if this saves any time from the game, but the idea of now the game is about to begin and they have the big send-up and the music and the fireworks and now here's the kickoff and they kick it through the end zone. Everybody runs down, nothing happens, and it's the most nothing burger of a play in all of professional sports. And sometimes then they go to a commercial break. So after the great big start of the game, there's no start of the game. I want them to somehow fix that. Either just give the team that wins the coin toss the ball on the 25-yard line and let's start playing football, or find a way to manage kick returns in a safer fashion. I don't know what that is.
Well, that's Yeah, well, I mean, that's, of course, the reason that they started. I think they've moved the line up for the kickoff so that more kicks would go out of the end zone.
Yep.
So because there's so many injuries on, because it's such a fast play with all the people running at full speed at each other. A lot of injuries on kickoffs. Kickoff has a strange, it's a strange beast. You're right. Maybe they just started the 25-yard line. I mean, I also have complaints about the way they run overtime games. I mean, the game the other night with the Jets, it seems like college football has it right. Every team gets the ball. They give it to them with a 25-yard line or 35-yard line. I can't remember where it starts. And then you get to see how you score. And then the next game, and this weird thing where if you score a touchdown, the other team doesn't even get to touch the ball. You can win in overtime.
Crazy.
I don't like that. I think the NFL has it all wrong on the overtime stuff. So I would really like to see them sort of rethink some of these rules, especially toward the end. I mean, for instance, when a team is coming down trying to score within the last minute of the game and they're behind, they have to throw it to the sidelines. They can't run the ball because unless they've got a bunch of timeouts left. And it seems like, well, why can't they just run football plays and the clock will stop and then they'll run another play, and then if the other team can stop them, then they can win the game.
Right.
And if they
play
can
football.
Play football, exactly. And I think that's an easily solvable problem. I don't have any illusions that it's going to happen. I did discover in researching this the other day that there have been proposals to have each quarter of football, have it be an untimed game like baseball, and each quarter you have 40 plays, no matter what the plays are. So each quarter is 40 plays long, and then that's it. That's the game. And, of course, you'd run into weird situations at the end of those games, too, where teams are just trying to run out plays. But that could work. So anyway, I feel like people need to think outside the box a little
Boy,
bit.
You are,
and they have over the years.
You have left the box, and the box is down the road now on that. But that's why we love you, Eric. That's Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, the weekly newsletter. He'll mail to you if you just email him, ericzorn@gmail.com, and he'll be part of the Mincing Rascals podcast again this week. We'll record that tomorrow and drop it tomorrow afternoon. Okay, EZ, let's visit then.
Thanks, John. See you soon.
That's Eric Zorn.